Welcome to Twice Blessed, a Yeshiva University Strauss Center podcast exploring Torah and Western thought. I'm your host, Shayna Trepido, and this season we're examining Shakespeare and the Hebrew Bible. It is a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Dr. Dov Lerner. Although born in London, which you'll be able to hear in just a moment, Rabbi Lerner has since lived in Israel, Chicago, and New York, and he currently serves as the rabbi of the Young Israel Synagogue of Jamaica Estates. As an undergraduate, Rabbi Lerner majored in English at Yeshiva University and received his rabbinical ordination from Reitz. He earned an MA in religion from the University of Chicago's Divinity School, as well as a PhD in the history of Judaism, focusing on the meaning of rabbinic and romantic traditions through the prism of biblical exegesis. In addition to pastoring and parenting, so in his 25-hour days, we are blessed to have him as a clinical assistant professor at Yeshiva University's Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought, where he conducts research, mentors students, and teaches some of our most popular courses, including Maimonides and His Enemies, the Malbim and Modernity, and Jewish Thought in the World to Come. Rabbi Lerner, thank you so much for being here.
It is an absolute pleasure.
So as you know, in this first season of the podcast, we're exploring moments of intersection where the Hebrew Bible is summoned, so to speak, to the Shakespearean stage to see how close examinations of the Jewish narratives and notions present in the plays might lead to a deeper understanding of Shakespeare's works and how the plays themselves can in turn inspire renewed and perhaps even revised reflections on the Hebrew Bible and Judaic thought. We've considered verbal echoes from the Psalms and verses from the Torah that appear in the plays. We've looked at plot parallels with stories such as Cain and Abel and Joshua and the spies and David and Saul, and where we find Shakespeare thinking with and through these paradigmatic episodes in his own plays. And we've even considered how Shakespeare's treatment of kingship and disability, blessing and loss, align with the Jewish approaches to such concepts and experiences. As the scholars I've spoken with have noted, Shakespeare carries all of this out with remarkable skill and nuance, which makes sense since he was living in an age of extreme censorship when the theater needed to remain a zone of religious neutrality. Due to these prohibitions and, frankly, the dangers involved in putting theology on the stage, rare indeed are moments when characters actually quote the Bible outright and ponder its meaning for their audience on the stage. However, a few such moments do exist, including the first conversation between Shylock and Antonio in The Merchant of Venice. Antonio, as we know, the Christian merchant, approaches Shylock, the Jewish moneylender, for a loan of 3,000 ducats for 3 months on behalf of his friend Bassanio, who needs the money to woo a rich lady in Belmont. As Antonio and Shylock discuss the terms of the loan, Antonio is quite open about his contempt for Shylock's profession and tells him that although he personally never lends or borrows with interest, he's willing to, quote, break a custom to help his friend. Shylock takes Antonio's denouncement of usury as an occasion of all things to bring up the story of Jacob and Laban from Genesis.
When Jacob grazed his uncle Laban's sheep, this Jacob from our holy Abraham was, as his wise mother wrought in his behalf, the third possessor. Aye, he was the third.
And what of him? Did he take interest?
No, not take interest. Not as you would say directly interest. Mark what Jacob did. When Laban and himself were compromised that all the eanlings which were streaked and byed should fall as Jacob's hire, the ewes, being rank in end of autumn, turned to the rams, and when the work of generation was, between these woolly breeders in the act, this skilful shepherd peeled me certain wands, and in the doing of the deed of kind, he stuck them up before the fulsome ewes, who then conceiving did in eaning time fall parti-coloured lambs, and those were Jacob's. This was a way to thrive, and he was blessed, and thrift is blessing, if men steal it not.
This was a venture, sir, that Jacob served for, a thing not in his power to bring to pass, but swayed and fashioned by the hand of heaven. Was this inserted to make interest good, or is your gold and silver ewes and rams?
I cannot tell. I make it breathe as fast.
Although Shylock finds this biblical anecdote relevant and even entertaining, listeners probably won't be surprised to learn that this exchange is often trimmed or just cut entirely from modern productions. It seems audiences today are just not as taken with biblical interpretation and debate as they once were. So as our exegesis expert, I'm wondering if you can offer some commentary on their commentary. Is Shylock's interpretation of Genesis 30 consistent with Jewish interpretive tradition, or is it merely Jewish, quote, in that it's spoken by a fictional Jew? In other words, what does Shylock or Shakespeare get right, and what does he get wrong?
So I'm not sure I'd classify myself as an expert of exegesis, but it's a fascinating clip. And this, if we go back to the story of Genesis, is after years where Jacob has toiled and tarried in the fields for the sake of Laban so that he could marry one of his daughters. And after 14 years and marrying two of his daughters and having kids, Laban and he come to a decision about how he can stay and maybe earn his own keep. And part of the agreement, Jacob turns to Laban and says, don't worry about paying me. I'll take my wages from the flock itself. You can have the light-colored sheep, and I'll have the spotted dark sheep, which on its face looks like Jacob's taking a raw deal, because usually sheep are white, hence the woolly colloquial image of a sheep. And then it turns out Jacob has what is seen as a ploy to ensure that he has a larger share of sheep. He, whether it is through metaphysics or genetics, he finds a way to ensure that the next generation of sheep are heavily spotted and dark, and the strong ones are the ones he gets to keep. So it's seen as, whether it's vengeful or an act of perhaps infidelity on his part to making the agreement, it's certainly seen as a form of trickery. And here Shylock is being used to voice that as a defense of his behavior, where he says, well, Jacob, pursuing his own interest to support his own family, can take advantage of what on its face looks underhand, but as long as it's part of the deal, it's part of the deal. And it seems that, at least on the surface, there is a twofold disagreement here between Antonio and Shylock. One is a theological debate, and the other is exegetical. As I said, neither of which I have expertise in. But it strikes me on its face that the theological disagreement is about the role we have in our own fate. That Jacob is being ventriloquized by Shylock here to suggest that we can take responsibility for our own lives. Jacob asserts himself. He makes a deal. He inserts himself into the condition of the sheep to ensure that he gets a good end to the bargain. So Jacob is assertive, he is aggressive in pursuing his own ends, and he sees himself as a subject who's responsible for his own fate. Antonio pushes back and suggests that we are objects of providence, that God gets to decide, and actually Jacob does well at that deal, not because he inserted himself into the events, but because God's grace and providence rewarded him. So that's the theological debate. But as you intimated, Shana, the exegetical debate here is really how to read this scene. It's just a question about how do we use the biblical text. And as you noted, he is being put in a position where he is projecting a Jewish view. But really, as you said, it's a Shakespearean view of Jews using the text where literally he is called the devil citing scripture for his purpose. He is being cast as a poor exegete, a miserly exegete, a narrow-minded exegete who doesn't give benefit of the doubt to the patriarchs, who uses the text to justify vice. It is a castigation of how Jews use the Hebrew Bible in many ways. And in many ways, it is an unjust representation of how Jews treat that text. And from a medieval perspective, Jews were not reading the text in that way at all. Although there has been a turn in modernity to see Jacob precisely in that way, to be almost hucksterish in his treatment of his uncle, where the word Lavan or Laban comes up again and again and again, describing Jacob's sheep, suggesting that maybe Jacob had become more Labanite or Lavan-like in the way that he had been behaved. and was using a ploy. But that's a modern turn. In the medieval period, Jews were not reading it that way or justifying vice in that way at all. So that's also, a launching pad for how Shylock is an unjust representation of the medieval Jew and Jewish tradition writ large.
Absolutely. That is so helpful. In seeing Shylock's interpretation, as you said, as an unjust representation of Judaism, is important to keep in mind. As we know, every act of representation, such as Shakespeare's representation of a Jew in the figure of Shylock, is itself an act of interpretation. And it's easy to overlook the fact that a commentator's approach or reading often reveals more about their own cultural concerns and their collective social anxieties than about the text that they're aiming to elucidate. And you also mentioned the medieval commentaries differing from modern ones. So for those who are interested in learning more about Merchant of Venice and medieval Jewry, I highly recommend listening to the Twice Blessed episode with Dr. Chayasima Konigsberg. It was historically rich and really moving. To your point about modern readings of Jacob and Laban and woolly breeders, I'm reminded of Leon Cass's essay in his book, The Beginning of Wisdom, that deals with Jacob's hucksterish nature. And perhaps this is one of the readings that you're thinking of too. His essay is aptly entitled The Adventures of Jacob, Taming of the Shrewd. It's a fantastic piece. And in a nutshell, Cass argues that Jacob, who he describes as a man of uncommon cunning and cleverness, in many ways the biblical counterpart of Odysseus, has to learn the limits of self-reliance, and he needs to become pious and dependent, really, on God's providence in order to become the blessed heir of Isaac and Abraham, or to become the third possessor, if you will. As Cass points out, and here maybe we can move to a slightly different topic, compared to Abraham and Isaac, arguably Jacob has the worst lot. Nothing comes easy to him. He's always a stranger in a strange land. And between the conflicts with his brother, his uncle, his wives, his sons, his daughter, it's not hard to imagine that Shylock is picturing Jacob when he says that sufferance is the badge of our tribe. And in the Hebrew Bible's account of the life of this third possessor, we often see suffering, especially among his sons and their relationship with Joseph, and then later with the abduction and rape of his daughter Dinah, suffering gives way to vengeance. In fact, only after Shylock's daughter Jessica runs off with the Christian Lorenzo, with the assistance of Antonio's entourage, and she takes with her a significant portion of her father's wealth, only then does Shylock first speak of exacting the pound of flesh penalty if Antonio should forfeit as a form of revenge.
Oh, I'm sure if you forfeit, you will not take his flesh. What's that good for?
To bait fish withal. If it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge. He hath disgraced me and hindered me 500,000, laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies, and what's his reason? I am a Jew! Hat thou a Jew eyes? Hat thou a Jew hands? Organs? Dimensions? Senses? Affections? Passions? Fed with the same food? Hurt with the same weapons? Subject to the same diseases? Healed by the same means? Warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge? If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferings be? By Christian example. Why revenge? The villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will bet the instruction.
So it's hard to follow Pacino, and it's also hard to talk about this extremely famous monologue that many actors, most notably Edmund Kean in the early 19th century, have used to transform Shylock from the comic villain that he would have been performed as in Shakespeare's day into a sympathetic, complex figure that could potentially evoke compassion for Jewish identity, as well as the suffering of all marginalized people whose shared humanity has been overlooked or even criminally erased. It's an incredibly powerful moment. But still, Shylock's rant on revenge at the end is unsettling. Now, he claims that he learned this villainous course of action from his Christian counterparts, and yet scholars for centuries have read The Merchant of Venice as a play that pits Jewish law and vengefulness against Christian mercy and forgiveness. So, now, leaving aside for a moment the fact that Shakespeare takes pains to highlight the hypocrisy of Antonio and his co-religionists throughout the play, as men that woo women based on their bank accounts and fail to keep their promises, I'm wondering if you could give us insight into Shylock's attitude toward retaliatory punishment. What exactly is the Jewish attitude toward revenge?
As you say, it's hard to follow Pacino, and the scene is incredibly striking. As we've noted, the humanizing character here is, when he says, "I've learned it from Christianity," he's not suggesting, of course, it's part of Christian doctrine, but Christians are hypocritical, that they see vengeance as beneath them, as a vice, yet by example, that's what they all do. And Pacino's defense, Shylock's defense in Pacino's voice of the behavior is not, it's mixed, because he begins with justified defenses, that I've been disgraced, I've been robbed, I've been mocked, I've been scorned, I've been thwarted, you've interfered with my family, my friends, my life. There are justifications for why he feels mistreated. But his defense of revenge is very much aligned with the view of vengeance as visceral, as impulsive. He connects it into three different stimuli. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And perhaps these three are not just arbitrary, but they speak to the totality of what it means to be human. Tickling, of course, being an external stimuli, poison being an internal effect of chemicals, and pricking and bleeding being at the threshold between the inside and the outside, saying in totality, we are as human as you are. And even though you've got this virtue ethic that suggests that mercy, compassion, forgiveness reign supreme, we know you don't live that way. And I will learn from you that to be human. So in that moment, Shylock is humanized, but vengeance is not lifted up as heroic by this humanized figure. It almost drags humanity down to the Jew rather than lifting the Jew up to humanity. And your question about vengeance in the Jewish tradition inspires me to quote a couple words from C.K. Salomon, a romantic, he was very romantic, Jewish literary critic of the 19th century, who, responding to this, what he considers an injustice, a representation of the Jewish people as vengeant and vicious and visceral, he says, "This characteristic," I'm now quoting his words, "has unquestionably no warrant in reality, no place in any authentic Jewish record, no sanction in Jewish laws, nor in rabbinic traditions." And he spends the rest of his article entitled Shylock from a Jewish Point of View defending a more virtuous image of the medieval Jew and suggesting that compassion has always been a primary Jewish virtue, with vengeance having no place. The true story is a little more complicated than that, and I'm not going to talk about hypocrisy or how Jews lived by example, but just as you say, from Jewish tradition, what do the sources prioritize? It is true that in Leviticus 19:18, there is a straightforward phrase that says, you shall not revenge. You shall not bear a grudge. It seems straightforward, unequivocal, as clear as could be. Vengeance is a vice. And it's in a chapter full of the supreme virtues and vices. And it comes to a point where it seems unquestionably vicious and bad. And the truth is, as Salomon suggests, rabbinic tradition expanded that prohibition not simply to apply to moments of violence or particularly vicious or graphic conflicts, but to the most ordinary of civic encounters, where the sages suggest that actually the biblical prohibition against revenge applies to not lending your neighbor sugar if they didn't lend you the previous day. That's a biblical prohibition. That's not simply good counsel. That's not simply a civic honor. That's not just a norm. That is a biblical mandate, that there is a prohibition. So Salomon has a defense in that sense, that it, vengeance is pushed away, is looked down upon. And there are, in the medieval context, all sorts of defenses as to why vengeance is so bad. Not that it's an arbitrary vice mandated by God, but that it is problematic in a very deep way. You've got Maimonides suggesting that it portrays a petty character, that to focus on how one has been wronged in small ways by neighbors and peers and friends is undermines the cosmic greatness that human beings can embody. You've got the anonymous anthologist who authored a book called The Chinuch in the medieval period, who suggested actually vengeance is a reflection of a misunderstanding of providence. If one wants to take revenge, then you put blame and hold responsible your neighbor for what they did for you. And this anonymous medieval author suggests that God dictates events and fate and providence. And if something has been wrong to you, that didn't come from your neighbor, that came from God. To assault them or to seek to assault them is a fundamental misunderstanding of providence, he would suggest. And others suggest that it's in materialism being rooted in this world and caring about petty things like Maimonides. Essentially, this whole stream of Jewish thought, originating with that biblical verse heading through the Talmud and the medieval commentaries, leads to the position that Francis Bacon ends up, where he suggests that revenge is a kind of wild justice. It is a vice. It is unquestionably bad. In the words of the Roman poet Juvenal, revenge is always the weak pleasure of a little and narrow mind. That seems to be the final word, and that's the position Salomon takes. As I suggested, it's a little more complicated than that. That is certainly a central thrust of Jewish tradition, but there is an inescapable, talking about exegetical problems, there is an inescapable paradox, it seems, in that God himself is described as vengeful. Time and time again, the prophet Nahum describes him as vengeful. King David, on numerous occasions, describes him as vengeful. At one point in Numbers, God instructs Moses to be vengeful. The most prominent instance of this is Psalms 94, where the psalmist literally describes God as a God of revenge. Kel Nekamot Hashem, God of vengeance, my Lord. So what are we to do with the fact that Jewish tradition seems to think that being vengeful is almost a supreme vice, and the supreme being is supremely vengeful? How do we resolve that? And there are actually some interesting resolutions that bring us to a middle path that in some ways may justify some of Shylock's behavior and vindicate his perspective. To resolve the paradox, as we noted, where God is, on the one hand, the author of a body of tradition that suggests that vengeance is a vice, and on the other, described in words that tradition ascribes to him as supremely vengeful, there are three routes to take to dissolve the contradiction. The first of which, as odd as it may sound, is to reevaluate God. The other is to mitigate the tension through a translation effort. And the third is to reevaluate vengeance.
They all sound simple, so sure.
They're very straightforward, very easy to do. Right. So the first avenue, which is not really available theologically to traditional Jews, is to reevaluate the God of the Hebrew Bible and say, you know what? The God of the Hebrew Bible doesn't match up to the virtues that he purports to be the ideal. And this is from figures from the New Atheist, like Richard Dawkins, who says in vivid, striking terms that I find it hard to say. He says in The God Delusion that the God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving, control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser, misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully.
That does not fit in a tweet.
Not even the 280, no. He is, he doesn't have strong feelings on the matter. But that's essentially the stream of thought that says, yeah, there is a irresolvable paradox in the Hebrew Bible in the virtues that it purports as ideals and the way the author is described. And the truth is, we don't have to go to Richard Dawkins. Thomas Jefferson said this almost the same thing, where in a letter to William Short in 1820, he says, Moses presented for the object of the Jews' worship a being of terrific character. And he didn't mean terrific in the British spiffing sense. He meant terrific, cruel, he goes on, vindictive, capricious, and unjust. He is almost where Dawkins draws his inspiration. So the first avenue is to say, yes, the Mosaic Old Testament, or what we call the Hebrew Bible, has a representation of God that does not do him justice because it falls into the territory of vice. So that avenue is obviously not available to traditional Jews who don't have a New Testament to, so to speak, correct or reimagine the old one. So the second avenue is to soften the language when God is described as a God of vengeance, for example, one of the liturgies used pretty broadly, at least in modern Orthodoxy, with a translation from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the term Kel Nukamot Hashem, my God of vengeance, my God, is translated as God of retribution, which already has connotations of justice associated with it and takes almost the visceral component or the vicious component of vengeance out of it. That avenue is a middle ground to resolve the tension, but it doesn't quite do justice, no pun intended, to the paradox, because the Hebrew term is still there. You can escape it in translation, but it's still there. And the third avenue is the route taken by the sages, which is to suggest we need to reevaluate revenge and suggest that revenge is not in totality a vice, that revenge in many ways is rooted in the instinct for justice. Of course, it might be petty if it, you know, if my neighbor didn't lend me sugar and I don't want to lend them sugar, it might be petty. But deep down, if taken seriously, it is a sense that injustice reigns in the world. And certainly Shylock has that defense in the opening part of that famous monologue. He suggests all the ways that he has been mistreated, all the ways that he's been persecuted and marginalized and dehumanized, and he's got real reason to feel there is injustice here, and I can't take it to court. I don't have a place to seek a just outcome, so I have to enact vengeance or retribution, we might call it. And the sages actually say in Aramaic, "Bemilta miha gadolahi," that in the right context, vengeance can be great. And it's an astonishing, almost radical description, which is in many ways evoked by Michael Ignatieff in his The Warrior's Honor, where he describes a lot of the civic unrest and ethnic war in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. And one of his claims is that we tend, In his words, I'll use his words, the chief moral obstacle in the path of reconciliation is the desire for revenge, which is commonly regarded as a low and unworthy emotion. And that's precisely how Shylock's vengeance is portrayed. It's precisely how Juvenal describes vengeance. It's precisely how we were assuming Leviticus portrays vengeance, that it is a low and unworthy, inhuman, visceral, animalistic emotion rooted in pettiness or a failure at some level to live up to what it means to be human. Ignatieff and the sages imply that actually there is something worthy. There is a kernel of worthiness at the core of revenge. In the words of Ignatieff, he says, morally considered, revenge is a desire to keep faith with the dead, to honor their memory by taking up their cause where they left off. And the way he puts it, not as an endorsement or a defense of vengeance, but as an explanation for why it is so powerful, he says, political terror is tenacious because it is an ethical practice. Vengeance can be petty, it can be visceral, but really it can also be ethical, a search for justice. Where Simon Wiesenthal called the Nazi hunter, even that terminology sounds visceral, but it is a search for justice. In fact, toward the end of his life, at one point, he himself made a similar remark. My cause was justice, not vengeance, he says. So what it seems is that vengeance, this middle ground is, when it is visceral, it is problematic. At least for the sages. In its context, though, when it is an instinct for justice, when it is severed from hate, it becomes great. It is the exemplary impossibility, meaning to live by example, an ethical vengeance is so impossible that it is eschewed. And rabbinic tradition overwhelmingly suggests we don't follow vengeance because it's impossible as human beings to sift out that hate. And really think that I want to educate the person. If I think about the way I'm raising my kids, there will be times where I will turn to one child and say, you didn't let them have your toy, so you can't have their toy. Is that not visceral vengeance? And of course the answer is, sometimes if I'm irritated, but other times, no, it is a pedagogic tool that they need to understand that their justice exists. Morality has its root in a sense of justice. And when I tell my child, that, or my daughter to be precise, that she can't have a toy, I'm not angry, usually. I'm not livid. I don't seek their downfall. I'm not viscerally in a place like Shylock where I feel dehumanized. I'm trying to teach a lesson. And the Jewish tradition, this middle ground where it falls, seems to be that if vengeance is a tool for education in a pure sense, where it has been severed from hate and fury and rage, and it is purely pedagogical, vengeance can be good. And that's precisely why God is described as a vengeful God, because he's not operating in a court setting. He is issuing justice by edict from on high. So when he is described as a God of vengeance, it is, in rabbinic tradition, in Jewish thought, severed from hate and pettiness and rage and fury, and purely the instantiation of justice. We can't quite embody that level of equanimity in the face of feeling wronged, which is why the kind of vengeance we see embodied in Shylock is such a negative connotation. And really, that seems to be the middle ground we fall in.
That's really fascinating that vengeance, is rightly understood and implemented without malice, can be an instrument for justice and, I guess, teaching ethical behavior to toddlers. In this light, it's also interesting that Shylock, although in the play he gives us all his reasons for hating Antonio and Antonio's reasons for hating him, when we get to the famous trial scene, Shylock is ostensibly emotion-free. He's there to seek impartial justice and enforcement of the law. Nothing about revenge. But then, in what follows, Shakespeare invites us to question whether real justice is even possible when it's rendered in courts that are run by humans, very flawed, biased humans. And even the prohibition against seeking vengeance in the Hebrew Bible speaks to this aspect of the human condition. So in that scene, we know Portia rules that Shylock can have his bond but draw no blood. And then she adds that the law has another hold on Shylock. And she explains that according to the statutes in Venice, if an alien like Shylock directly or indirectly attempts to take the life of another citizen, that citizen is automatically entitled to half of the alien's goods and the other half goes to the state. And then she adds that it also stipulates that the offender's life lies in the mercy of the Duke. Now, the Duke takes this opportunity, of course, to not sentence Shylock to death, and therefore the popular reading of this play for generations has been as a, you know, triumph for Christian mercy. But by modern standards, as evidenced by many of the mock appeals of Shylock's case that have been done, for instance, the one that was done in 2017, presided over by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in honor of the 500th anniversary of the Venetian ghetto, Shylock is seen to be punished disproportionately, and he's shown no mercy. So what I see in this play at the end is Portia's hermeneutic expertise, right? Her ability to read the contract and interpret it accordingly in a way that allows Antonio's life to be saved, that's praiseworthy. But as soon as she gets that reading that the court seeks, then the play slips back into these prejudiced reading practices and law becomes slippery. In fact, as soon as the Duke grants mercy, Antonio petitions the court for what he calls, quote, a favor, and he asks for the Jew to presently become Christian, and he demands his conversion, even though there is no alien statute, there's no legal necessity that requires that within Venetian practice. So earlier in the play, as you mentioned, Antonio warns that the devil can cite scripture for his purpose, and he's suggesting that an application of Shylockian hermeneutics would result in a world that's just overrun by cruel devils and each man is serving his own need. And yet the Christian triumph in the courtroom scene that Shakespeare designs still provides for this capricious and abusive legal system that pronounces rulings that don't follow from a text or any kind of statutes and really just seem to be governed by impulse and sentiment, which is itself also extremely dangerous. So I guess I have to thank you for indulging me thus far, and perhaps we can wrap with just one more question. So in his book, Violence and the Sacred, 20th century French theorist René Girard argues that mimetic desire, or the innate drive that we have to want what others have, inevitably results in conflict and violence. And in this study, he claims, quote, "Vengeance is a vicious circle whose effect on primitive societies can only be surmised. For us," he then distinguishes, "the circle has been broken. We owe our good fortune to one of our social institutions above all, our judicial system, which serves to deflect the menace of vengeance." So Girard's claim is really an interesting one. And he has, you know, another piece called To Entrap the Wisest. It's also about The Merchant of Venice, and he extends this theory, and he looks very carefully at Shakespeare's complex critique of scapegoating, and it's definitely worth reading. But given what we've seen in, I guess, even just current events, I'm wondering if you think Girard's claim that the legal system can end cycles of vengeance still stands up. I mean, we have a 400-plus-year-old play here that shows us the judicial system does not restore loss adequately, and it can't mend resentment and persecution fully. In fact, we have Shylock's last words in the play, which suggest everything's fine. He says, "I am content," but it sits so uncomfortably with audiences. In fact, this whole play in Act 5 ends with a bunch of people who don't seem very content or happy at all. Even those reunited couples, based on what they've now learned about their respective partners, and directors have really wrestled with how to end this play satisfactorily. So I'm wondering if maybe you can give us some kind of alternative ending here. Do you think that the law can be a vehicle for achieving resolution and resolving conflict? Or, I guess, put a better way, what does Jewish tradition have to offer us in terms of ending the cycle of resentment and contempt and vengeance?
It's a good question. It seems to me that on a pragmatic level, the judicial system can bring an end to a cycle of violence. Built with enough enforcement mechanisms or given enough reverence by the public, judicial systems can resolve conflict. Having said that, it doesn't really resolve the impulse for justice. It just may bring a stop to violence out of an arbitrary convention. And arbitrary is exactly the word, in the sense that judicial systems really are a form of arbitration where we all come together and we agree to settle a matter, though that doesn't quite empty our hearts or our minds of fury or rage. It just lets us walk away because we agreed to this. It's almost contractual. The Jewish response, while of course also advocating for a judicial system, which in many ways in Jewish thought can be seen in arbitrary or arbitrational terms, I should say, rather than eternal providential justice. And in many ways, the judicial system is not built to resolve final theological, deep emotional questions, but just resolve conflict. It seems to me the response to vengeance on the part of Jewish tradition is found in the very same verse that commands and prohibits vengeance, which is, again, Leviticus 19:18 begins, "Do not enact revenge, do not bear a grudge." And then the second half of that verse is perhaps the more famous half, "And you shall love your neighbor like yourself." The instincts that Girard sees as the kernel to all violence and vengeance, that mimetic desire to see what others have and want it for ourselves, is almost inverted in Jewish tradition, where there is the opposite mimetic impulse, which is not to see what others have and want it for ourselves, but to see what we give ourselves and give that to others, to see how we have compassion and mercy and forbearance and forgiveness and patience with ourselves, and try to apply that in a mimetic sense to the other, and find a way that if we wish to seek justice, to do it pedagogically, to do it strictly severed from petty impulse or visceral rage, and to find a way that justice should reign, but in a way that is cool and tempered and loving.
On that note, thank you so much, Rabbi Lerner, for offering your cool, tempered, and insightful teachings. It's been a joy speaking with you, and I do hope that you'll be back to bless us with more very soon.
Amen.
Thank you for listening to Twice Blessed, a project of the Yeshiva University Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought. This show is produced by Uri Westrich and Sam Gelman. Information about this episode, including the audio credits and reading recommendations, is available in the show notes. If this conversation left you feeling blessed, please subscribe to Twice Blessed on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and consider leaving a positive review, sharing it with friends, and following us on social media. Thanks for listening!